people like concrete rules, and when they're sold rules, they want to make sure that they're getting what they bought into. I always bring this up, but we saw this happen with the NFL's domestic violence policy, where you come out and hammer and say 6-day minimum right. with room for less or more in yeah. the fine print, and all of a sudden you get yourself into trouble because you're not delivering on what you promised. And if it's something in a vein of something you're truly interested, like pace of play, that's a mistake.
It was a first step at a time when the dysfunction is greater than I've seen in 15 years. And the relationship between the two sides is the worst it's been in 15 years. I'm going to be curious to see if during the course of the summer, if the players on the field, it'll essentially be civil disobedience. Okay, the rule is 6. Well, you know what? If I go to a 7th time, an 8th time, a 9th time, what are you going to do? I do wonder if Manfred, you know, is seeing the reaction to this and thinking to himself, you know what? If we were going to have all of this discord and his public complaining, and maybe that it even goes on during the course of the summer, I wish I'd just come out, okay, fine. You know what? I'll put in the pitch clock. If we're going to have complaining either way, we might as well go in hard. The reason why there's so many mound visits now is because of the fact that the runner at second base will often steal signs and relay them back to the hitter. And that's why they go out and do verbal signs between the catcher and the pitcher so often.
The games in 2005 were much, much shorter. That's at least yep. what the graphic said this morning. I'm not sure. You know, if it were me and people that get paid to do this, that's what they're here to do. You know, I'm here to pitch, I'm here to play baseball, but I would just simply go 2005. Hey, what was in 2005 that was causing these games to be much shorter, and what do we have now? Is it the replay system? Is it the fact that technology, you know, is very advanced, so players individually, maybe rightfully so, or maybe just because we're guaranteeing everything is a fair playing field, are we taking longer? You know, I don't know what that answer is. The whole thing they showed was maybe 3 or 4 minutes long. For that to be their big emphasis, I don't think that's it, and I just think that it does more harm than good, at least from the pitching side.
For a couple years now, people have said, let's just put the best 16 teams in the playoffs, which in theory could mean 11 teams from the West and 5 from the East in a year. This is not that. This is why this has a fighting chance. Because honestly, think about this. For a vote to pass in the NBA, you need 20 out of 30 owners to vote for something. If you're an Eastern Conference owner, if you're even one Eastern Conference owner, why would you vote for straight 1-16? Adam is saying, still have 8 teams from each conference make it. So, you know, that no team in the East would not make the playoffs. But then seed 1-16 amongst those teams. Ideally, you'd like to have your 2 best teams meet in the finals. That would be better for fans. We're not there yet. There's some travel things. There still would have to be some modifications to the schedule. But that would have a fighting chance of getting 20 of 30 votes.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
I'm not one of the 30 NBA owners, but I can tell you this, it's gotten my vote. Abso-bleepin-lutely. Welcome to the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5, the ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Apologies if I sound subdued today a little bit. It's only because I'm going to try to keep my voice and thus my temperature both down. Thanks to Jim Cushman yesterday. Cush, appreciate you sitting in.
No problem.
I woke up on Sunday with one of those funks that everybody's getting.
That's what happens when it goes from 35 to 65.
Yeah, right on. You know, you're exactly right. But, so many people have been sick, and I've been pushing it and fighting it off, and I succumbed to it on Sunday. It was really bad yesterday, and it's not a whole hell of a lot better today, but good enough for me to be in, and I appreciate you sitting in for me yesterday. I do side with what you just heard Brian Windhorst talking about at the end of that exceptional montage, once again put together by Cush. Absolutely reseed the NBA playoff teams 1-16 so that we can see what we want to see, and that is the 2 best teams playing at the end of the season, at the end of the playoffs, in the finals. And if that has to mean Golden State versus Houston, then it means Golden State versus Houston. And if an Eastern Conference team says, no way, that's not fair, okay, then here's your option. Beat Golden State or Houston. Beat them in the playoffs, and then you will go to the finals just like you always have. That is a really interesting conversation, one that we will be exploring a little bit later on in the program, in this hour, as a matter of fact. Also, more rules changes in the sports that we seem to care the most about here, at least I can say that way, and that, of course, would be the baseball pace of play adjustments. I'm just going to call them adjustments, and I'm not going to say much more about them because, you know, what did Mom always tell you? If you don't have something nice to say, don't say anything at all. Well, that kind of belies the whole nature of sports talk radio. So I suppose I have to say some things about individuals that I do not necessarily like in this case. But I'm just really, really disgusted and frustrated with Rob Manfred, the commissioner of Major League Baseball. I really, really am. He came out. Kush, do you remember? Well, he reiterated it as recently as a week ago.
I touched on this yesterday because this is when this announcement came out.
Yeah, and it was about maybe a month ago, you know, and I lose track of time sometimes, in which, you know, Manfred essentially said, we don't need the Players Association to sign off on a pitch clock. If they don't like it, tough crap, we're doing it because it's the right thing to do about the pace of play.
And
sounded like he was ready to go, and he was all fired up, and you know, Manfred was going to make his presence felt here. And then when push comes to shove, as you just pointed out yesterday, it's like, well, we won't have a pitch clock, but we will limit the number of visits to the mound to 6 per team, which is, by the way, an extraordinarily high number of pitches to the mound for non-pitching changes. It will change nothing. Nothing. That's nothing. If you're scoring at home, nothing will change. 6 trips that are non-pitching change trips. How many? I mean, do you have stats on that?
Coach, no, unfortunately,
I
don't.
Stats on what the average number of pitching mound conferences is in a game, with or without pitching changes. Because that's 12 in a game, not counting the pitching change ones. And the pitching change one, when you've got a matchup manager like Terry Francona, for example, going lefty, lefty, righty, righty, and on down the line, you know, those pitching changes don't count against the stats. 6, just stop out and say hi and, you know, let's go over the signs once again, visits per game, and that's going to change the pace of play and shorten the duration of these games? What an absolutely anticlimactic end to what was a very, very, you know, excitable prospect of finding a way to make the game, you know, pick the game's pace up just a little bit to keep people interested a little bit more.
Yeah, a couple of things on this. One, for technicality reasons, in addition to how you spell that, well, I'm just going to do it anyway. Well, technically, they proposed these a year ago, and that's why a year later he's able to just do it or not do it, regardless of what the union thinks. Just throwing that out
right,
there
but
technically.
But he chose not to, though.
Correct. Correct. And at the end of the day, if you're going to do, and I pointed this out yesterday when I was talking about this, because it came out yesterday, if you're going to do the mound visit thing, and yes, for the record, anybody who's watched or, like myself, umpired high school baseball of any kind, that's already there. It's less than 6, but that's the general principle of it. It's not going to affect much. The only time I could see this coming into play at all, because it's not just the pitching coach coming out, they're counting if the catcher's going to go out to the mound, too. That's going to count as one.
Or if the shortstop wants to come up and, you know, like hand him the ball and then whisper into his ear. Do they count that as one?
Yes. Yes, they will. The only time I could really see this affecting gameplay is if you're in a high-scoring extra-inning game. Then maybe you've run out of your 6 because you're going back and forth.
But they give you an extra one in the extra-inning game.
Right, then there's that. If you go to the extra innings, then you get an extra free one. But the thing is,
so in other words, in a regular 9-inning game, this will have no impact whatsoever,
minimal,
in my estimation.
I think it'll be minimal. And even more so, if the goal is pace of play, to me anyway, and maybe I'm just, you know, out on a limb on this one, but this is how I'm interpreting it. If the goal here is pace of play, you're doing this, but not the pitch clock thing, then it's negligible. It's kind of negligible because mound visits are like 30 seconds or something. If you're in a situation where you're actually over that and forced to make the pitching change, well, now that's the 2-3 minute type of, you know, between inning or during innings pitching change that we're always talking about. So for the most part, if pace of play is the goal, I feel doing this without the pitch clock, it's going to be negligible in terms of improving the pace of play thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally negligible. I mean, to the point of nothing. Like that's why I said, this will do nothing. This will do nothing about the pace of play. The other thing that they're doing, by the way, is, of course, shortening commercial breaks during the regular season. Big deal. So
yes.
20 seconds less of commercials. The regular breaks between innings for commercials were 2:25, you know, television breaks.
Right.
Now they're 2:05.
Okay.
For the nationally televised games, they go from 2:45 to 2:25, which, again, is just 20 seconds difference. Postseason games will still be 2:55 because they got to make their money.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not even concerned about the long commercial breaks, to be honest with you. That has nothing to do with the, quote, pace of play.
Right.
The pace of play is that period of time in which play is happening. And whether or not it's fast enough to, you know, capture and keep the interest of the casual fan in my, because that's what this is all about to me. The whole idea, of course, is to increase ratings, increase ticket buyers, get more butts in the seats, and convince them that it's not boring to watch a pitch thrown every 70 seconds. You know, by putting that 20-second pitch barrier up, which they had considered that Manfred essentially threatened them with, saying we can do it unilaterally.
Heck, as about a month ago, I assumed they were going to do it.
That's right.
All indications.
And I was so excited about that, because the bottom line is, if you look at a regular baseball game and a pitcher who, let's say, who's not a fast worker and he's not one of the extraordinarily slow workers.
Right,
you know,
okay, average.
You know who those guys are. The average guy. I mean, the time that it takes between, you know, the ball being received by the catcher and returned to the pitcher, the time that it takes for both batter and pitcher to get themselves ready is ridiculous. That is what has people yawning, looking at their phones, trying to find something else to do to pass the time. There's nobody on, and we're going to stand there and act as if each pitch is the pitch that's the, you know, the full count, bottom of the ninth, seventh game of the World Series pitch. I've got to make this one just right. And each hitter has to adjust every part of his body stepping out of the box in between each pitch, and it is just a drag. It is a slow, methodical, quite frankly, I don't want to use the B word, but it is a boring process that turns fans off. So limiting mound visits and shortening commercial breaks, in my estimation, is literally pointless. The idea is keep the play moving, the pace of play moving. I mean,
the idea is to make it so that no one can
between pitch number one and the inevitable ground out to second that is coming, you know, in a given at bat.
Yeah,
it is just pointless. The hit, you know, for those who don't know too, Jim, the rule modification. First of all, there's always been a pitch clock on the books.
Technically speaking, yes.
That's right. It has never been enforced, but it's
right.
Always been there. All they had to do was enforce it. And in this case, they weren't even going to enforce it to its by the letter of the law reading in MLB rules, which I believe, I want to say, is like 12 or 13 seconds is the way that it's written in the books. And I looked it up the last time around, but I'm trying to commit it to memory. But if there's no one on base, and thus a pitcher doesn't have to keep checking first or second or wherever it might be, and keeping a runner close, in which case, of course, there will be more time spent. But if there's no runners on base that would demand a pitcher's attention, the pitcher needs to deliver the next pitch, or at least be in his windup or in his stretch and in the motion. It was like 12 or 13 seconds from the time he received the ball back from the pitcher or the catcher. Now, they were going to not even go by that, and they were going to extend that to 20 seconds, which is still a long time, plenty enough time for the pitchers to get ready, provided, of course, the hitters are ready.
And as we know, they've been doing that in the minor leagues. This will be the second or third season with that.
Third or fourth. I think they've been doing it for 3 years now.
Actually, you're right. This will be the third or fourth season, correct? Yeah.
Yeah. So the rule that they were going to put in place, again, that Rob Manfred could have done unilaterally, that baseball could have done unilaterally, because of the reason that Jim just brought up, that it was proposed a year ago, would have said that if the batter is not ready to receive the pitch within that 20-second period, then it is going to be an automatic strike called against him. So we're not just putting this all on the pitchers.
Right.
But if the batter is not ready and in the box and ready to go, the umpire will assess a strike call. If the pitcher is not delivering within that 20-second period, then they will automatically give the batter an advantage and call a ball.
That's how it's supposed to be, yes, by the rule.
Which is exactly how it should be, in my estimation, because that will keep people's attention. That will keep eyes on the pitcher and on the batter at all times, and not just this long, winding period that, quite frankly, is boring.
Yeah.
And I love baseball.
I do, too.
So when I use the boring word there, you know, it hurts. I don't like to say that because I like the game so much, but it really, really is. And these games dragging out to 3 hours and 15 minutes long for a nine-inning baseball game is because of the that pace of play that we're talking about, Jim. It's just they had a chance to deal with it here, and they dropped the ball.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
That's exactly right. They dropped the ball on this one.
And oh, by the way, did you happen to listen to Golic and Wingo this morning?
Parts of it, yeah.
This part I did not realize until I heard them this morning. According to, it was Mike Golic Jr., actually, who brought this up. There's no teeth to the mound rule. Meaning, the visits to the mound rule. Meaning, there's no punishment outlined in the rule. You know, because like I just said, with the pitch clock, if the pitcher didn't have, you know, it wasn't in his windup and ready to go in 20 seconds, it's a ball. And if the batter isn't ready, it's a strike. But they haven't said anything. What happens if a shortstop comes up and makes an extra visit to the mound? What happens in the ninth inning and we're all out of our six, you know, mound visits mm-hmm. that we're allowed, and the catcher wants to go and chat up the pitcher to make sure they're clear on the signs because they got crossed up? Or maybe they feel like the guy on second is stealing signs, so we got to go out and make the change. What Golic Jr. said on Golic and Wingo this morning, and we hope you listen to that every day right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. I think they're doing a great job, by the way. A lot of people thought the end of the world was coming when Mike and Mike was disbanded, but I think they're doing a great job. But Jim, according to what Golic Jr. said, is there is no punishment outlined that a manager or a catcher or whomever who wants to come out, or a pitching coach, and come out and talk, if they've already reached their six mound visit limit and they come out, the umpire can say, hey, you're not allowed to do that, and the catcher can say, yeah, what are you going to do about it?
Right. No, that's
because
true.
Because there's no teeth to it. It's no, what is it, an out? Is there a fine coming? Is the punishment going to be baseball related to the game at hand, or is it going to be financial because you violated what we said when we said six? Because they established no repercussions for breaking the rule, and I've never seen anything quite like
that. No, and you're completely correct about it. Again, I found the ESPN.com article on this one from yesterday that I was referencing because they have a little picture of the actual like legalese of
yeah.
this rule itself, and nowhere in this does it mention anything about, well, what happens if they go over their six? because this is how it's done at the high school level that I'm somewhat familiar with, when those happen, I'm supposed to take out my little scorecard and mark by the team that, okay, mound visit, okay, mound
right.
visit. But even doing that, here in the Major League one, there's nothing outlining about, you know, what happens if this is their seventh visit and it's the ninth inning or something? There's
happening.
Nothing happening. Yeah.
I mean, if I'm a catcher and we've already had our six.
All that most the umpire can do in this situation is go up there
and say, get back there.
And say, well, no, you're over your limit. You got to make a pitching change. But as you're pointing out, as Gold Jr. point out, there's no actual enforcement.
Right.
Technically, the teams could say to the umpire, and you and what army are going
right,
to make
exactly.
me.
Technically,
if I'm a catcher, they could.
And I want to go out and clear you
right.
know, clarify the signs with my pitcher late in the game, and I'm already past my six.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's going to say, hey, you can't do that. I'm going to say, I'll just be a minute. I'll be right back. I'll just be a couple seconds. Because what are you going to do? You're not going to – you can't eject me. And if you can, it better be in that rule. What do you said you're looking at it right now, the actual legal –
the actual legalese
the language
kind of
the, of it,
the
yeah.
language of it
does
right
it
now.
Does it say a player who does this
nope.
shall be ejected?
Nope.
Nope.
It says nothing about.
Does it say a manager? Show,
nope.
Does it say we're gonna give the batting team an extra out this inning?
Nope. It says nothing about what the punishment for someone. It lays out what they constitute as a mound visit for this purpose. And by the way, the extra inning one is every inning an extra inning. By the way, you get one.
You get one.
So it's not
yeah.
just. The fullness of extra innings, it's you get one in the 10th, one in the 11th, and yada, yada, yada.
That's just ridiculous.
That's
too.
Ridiculous, too, by the way. But,
and
yeah,
again,
there's nothing in here about enforcement and what
team.
Would have to be done if a team is violating it. So
wow.
it sounds like all that the umpire could do is go out there like they do when there's a mound visit going on, and they eventually see the umpire going up there where he's really, in the past, been telling him, okay, your time's up, got everybody get back. All he could do is go up there and say, you're over your limit, you have to make a pitching change now. But technically speaking, Golic Jr. is right. There is no teeth to this. The team and the manager and whoever could just technically, if they want to, look at the umpire and tell him to get bent.
I want my pitch clock. First of all, if you're going to have this rule, have some teeth to it. You have
yes.
to lay out the punishments. They can't just say you're out of here and
right.
eject somebody for taking that seventh visit to the mound. They can't do it because it wasn't
right.
laid out in the agreement. And I want my pitch clock. I'm reading from... CBS sports writer Mike Axisa, something like that. Anyway, He said it's not gone forever, the pitch clock idea, because MLB and Manfred have been pushing this hard, and that's not going to stop. They've merely tabled the talks for the rest of this year. It doesn't mean they won't bring it, you know, next year. It's not like they've just killed the idea. So that's good news. Although, you know what, why wait? Let's get this done now. But he also writes, keep in mind that the 20-second pitch clock has been used at the AA and AAA levels for three seasons now. An increasing number of big league pitchers pitched with a pitch clock in the minors. So it wouldn't even require a major adjustment for them. They are used to it.
Right. The younger you are, the more used to it you're going to be. Yep.
Yeah, the older veterans won't be used to it, but guess what else? There is this thing called spring bleeping training games. They're going to play 30 games, roughly, in which they can take the time to get used to the pitch clock and having to move at a certain pace.
And those start at the end of this week, by the by.
I know. How about that? The MLBPA won this battle. There won't be a pitch clock in 2018. Expect MLB and Manfred to revisit the topic after this season. I certainly hope that is the case. By the way, I got a text message from a listener named Andy who says, just limit the number of times a batter can step out of the box and readjust his batting gloves to one per at-bat. That would save about 90 minutes a game.
Well,
that
just
is true,
do it. Man, then just do what you're really saying. You don't want, you're doing this for Mike Hargrove because you don't want anyone else to have the human rain delay nickname. That's what this is all about.
But
conspiracy,
is, you know,
I tells you.
I would support that, too. Just as much as I would support the pitcher has to be ready in 20 seconds, the batter, absolutely. You must stay in the box for your entire bat save for one time. One time you can regather yourself.
Kidding aside, that's a great point. Kidding aside.
And maybe you allow a little latitude if there's, you know, some chin music or something. If somebody steps out after two or three pitches and just kind of takes a couple of cuts and, okay, that's your one time stepping out. And then he gets one buzzed by his chin at some point in the at bat. Excuse me. To me, he has my permission to step out and dust himself off and get himself, you know, get his blood pressure back down a little bit, slow his heart rate down, and get ready for the rest of the at-bat, because there are some circumstances that should be considered there. But, this is frustrating. I thought baseball was going to do something very, very exciting here, and instead they've done nothing. And the one thing that they did do, while still being a big nothing burger, is unable to be enforced because they have no teeth to no punishment outlined.
By the way, speaking of these other rules, did you catch the other sub-rule change that they're putting in? Because we're all focused on the mound visits and the no pitch clock thing. Did you catch this one?
Which one?
I'll just read this paragraph from the ESPN.com article from yesterday. To assuage players' concerns about sign stealing, I love the clandestine nature of this rule, by the way, in that humor way. MLB will install new telephone lines from dugouts to video replay rooms. MLB said the lines will be monitored and a person familiar with the decision told the AP all the conversations on the lines will be recorded. They're going all CIA tap your phone style. Did you catch this one?
I did see something about it, but I didn't read all of the details and the legalese, as they say they were in it. So tell you what, Jim, let's hit that again a little bit more on the other side. I'm going to get a bottom of the hour Sports Center. Also, next half hour, I want to talk more about Adam Silver and some potential changes on the NBA side when it comes to the playoffs and seeding of teams. Could we see two Western teams or two Eastern teams in an NBA Finals? Adam Silver says kind of, sort of, yes. And we want to get your thoughts on it, too. 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065. For now, let's get wild.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents the Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings, wings, beer, sports.
Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day. Today, let's talk about rebounders, some of the best in the game, including one currently playing in the D. In NBA history, there have been only four players to lead the league in rebounding at the All-Star break for three straight seasons. Those names are Wilt Chamberlain, Hall of Famer, Moses Malone, Hall of Famer, Dwight Howard, multi-time All-Star, borderline, probably not a Hall of Famer. And yes, indeed, Andre Drummond. Andre Drummond of the Pistons leads the league right now 15.7 boards per game, which is a career high. And if he continues at that rate for the whole season, he'll be the first player since Dennis Rodman in 96-97 to average more than 15.5 boards for an entire season. That is your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day. Sports Center coming. Let's get you on the radio next right here on The Ticket.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Back indeed we are on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, where we are and will remain Toledo's sports leader. Yeah, so if you've got thoughts on the pace of play thing that we were just discussing, I'd love to hear from you because this is the half hour to get in right now, well, the next 21 minutes anyway before top of the hour, because coming up at about 4:10 after the top of the hour local sports center, Von Lozen going to join us from MazeAndBrew.com. Kush, how come we don't give more love to Michigan basketball?
I don't know. We should. Our sister station is their affiliate, but we're doing it today, doggone it.
We talk to Paul Keels on a regular basis, obviously. From Ohio State, of course, and give some love to the Buckeyes.
I have a feeling we'll be having Michigan people on a weekly basis between now and whenever they're done in the tournament, because they're still going there, too.
Yeah, well, no question. And, you know, especially since they're playing way better basketball. I mean, they just beat Ohio State. The Buckeyes have now lost two in a row to Purdue and Michigan, and we should get some love to that. You know, we spend time talking MAC all the time. In fact, we talk with Todd Kowalczyk, the coach of UT basketball, once a week. We talk with Michael Huger, the coach at BG basketball, once a week, or in his stead, if he is out on recruiting trips or whatnot. We'll talk to Todd Walker, which will be the case today at about 4:40. But we just have been conspicuous, I think, in our negligence, I guess, of Michigan basketball. And you know what? The Wolverines are quietly putting together a nice little late-season run here to get a really good seed in the Big Ten tournament, and then obviously pushing forward to the NCAAs, Jim.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they've been a ranked team for weeks on end now. They might not be as sexy of a story for this season the way Ohio State might be, considering nobody expected, including us, anything from them, but they've been a consistently ranked or just about ranked team all year, and therefore, depending on what bracketologist you're looking at, I've seen them anywhere between 6 and 9 on any line. They'll make the tournament. So, we're going to talk some more Michigan over the next couple weeks. No doubt about it.
If they win their last two and then do a nice deep run into the Big Ten tournament, I think they could increase that number to a top five seed in one of the regions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if they go to something like the Big Ten title game, particularly if they finish in the top four and go to the quarters instead of the second round, that always makes a difference because, you know, when you play back-to-back-to-back-to-back days or whatever in one of these conference tournaments, that might help them. If they go pretty far, they could bump that seed line up
I'm going to use this as the main reason I brought up Michigan basketball is to promote the interview we're going to do at 4:10. Von Lozen, MazeAndBrew.com, is going to talk about the Wolverines' win over Ohio State, maybe preview the Big Ten tournament, see what kind of a chance they have, or, you know, is this still Sparty Town now that Purdue has kind of struggled a bit? Ohio State has dropped off as Michigan State. So I'm going to use this now, though, as a segue into an entirely different topic. Just two nights ago, what would it have been? Sunday, I guess it would have been.
Sunday night, yep.
No, it wasn't Sunday because I was watching some of the NBA All-Star game. But at some point on
Sunday. The All-Star game was Sunday.
What's that?
The All-Star game was Sunday.
I know, that's what I'm saying. So what I'm about to say, it couldn't have been then because I was watching the All-Star game.
I got you, okay.
But at some point over the weekend, I saw again, because, you know, they replay these 30 for 30s from time to time.
Yep.
I saw the 30 for 30 on Fab 5.
That's a great one. I DVR'd that so I can watch it again at my leisure.
Well, I watched it again, and it was just kind of funny. First of all, it really, really saddens me that those guys, you know, Chris Webber and Jalen Rose and Juwan Howard, that they're still kind of at odds. Well, basically everybody's at odds with Chris Webber because he's the only one who won't admit to his mistakes as a very, very, very young man and taking that money from Ed Martin, some $280,000, and that's the source of contention. You know, Jalen admits he took some things, but they were much, much smaller. And everybody has kind of admitted their role. Ed Martin can't because he's passed on. But everybody's kind of admitted their role except for Chris. And that has been a source of contention because his was the largest transgression. And thus the reason why the Wolverines were forced, after the investigation was concluded, to vacate all of their wins, including the national championship game appearance, Final Four, the Fab Five, you know, legacy was essentially wiped out. Banners gone from Chrysler Arena, right? And that is continuing to be a source of, you know, disagreement and tension between them. And it makes me sad because they ought to be able to look back at those days and really, you know, kind of revel in how they changed college basketball. Because they did.
Yes, they did.
In a lot of ways. And I loved every second of it, by the way.
Honestly, I've thought about it, and I wasn't as big a fan in the moment, and that's probably stems from that famed regional final overtime game in their first run where they played the Buckeyes. But looking back on it, I'm actually mad that I wasn't a bigger fan of them.
Well, you know what's interesting, Jim? I was more of a fan of them in the same way that I was always more of a fan of the Showtime Lakers as opposed to their nemesis,
the Celtics,
which was Duke in the Michigan saga.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the Fab Five.
Right.
And the Celtics. And it's weird. I liked Flash. I liked Flair. You know, I liked Showtime.
Well, they had that spades, no doubt.
I do, and that's what, you know, and I never liked Larry Bird and Kevin McHale and Bill Walton and all those guys because they just didn't play the game the way I liked to see it played and that I wished I could have played it. You know, and, you know, there's what's interesting is the little racial tone there that's between the two. You know, the Celtics were very well known for being a predominantly white roster, Jerry Seesting, Danny Ainge, Kevin McHale, Bill Walton, Larry Bird, and on down the line. I mean, not, I shouldn't say predominantly, but certainly much more than anybody else in the NBA. And
at the time, yeah.
75 to 80% African-American league, even though you have many, many more European and Asian and other, you know, people coming in from other parts of the world. But it's weird, you know, Duke also with Christian Laettner and Bobby Hurley and all those, you know, a lot of the white players. I just had an affinity for Lakers basketball and Michigan basketball when it came down time to those things. They were just better. They were more fun, you know, and the race part didn't matter to me. The style did. But today people, of course, take note of the racial components of those. They talked about how, you know, Michigan was hip hop and they brought hip hop and black socks and baggy pants to the court and upset the white establishment. And I didn't give a crap about white establishment in 19, what years are we talking about?
1990 through 93.
92, 93, yeah. I didn't give a crap about any of that stuff. The racial stuff didn't matter to me. I just liked the style. Anyway, I'm getting off the track here. Point I'm trying to make is they had to vacate their wins and thus their Final Four and title game appearances, right?
Right.
Well, I think it was Jimmy King on the 30 for 30 that I rewatched over the weekend who said, it might have been Jalen, but I think it was Jimmy King, who said, ask anybody who the starting lineup was for North Carolina when we lost. When Chris Webber called that infamous timeout.
Mm-hmm.
Ask who the starting lineup for North Carolina was. Nobody knows. Ask who the Fab Five was and started that game for us. Everybody knows. He says, you take the banners down if you want, but nobody's ever going to forget what we did. And it's so true. It is so true. I don't even know if I can remember one of the starting members of the Tar Heels in that 93 final. But I remember the Fab Five.
Yeah.
And I bring that up now, Jim, to segue into one of the other huge news stories of the day. The University of Louisville has been forced to vacate its 2013 national championship. And they must take their banner down after the NCAA decided to uphold the penalties levied against them. Interim Louisville president Greg Postel, I'm not exactly sure how he says it, had some very, very strong remarks about this. He thinks the NCAA is doing the Cardinals dirty.
Actions Appeals Committee announced that it had upheld earlier imposed penalties on the University of Louisville, inclusive of financial penalties and the vacation of victories between 2011 and 2015, the 2013 National Championship, and the 2012 Final Four appearance. I cannot say this strongly enough. We believe the NCAA is simply wrong to have made this decision. We felt that the young men who achieved these victories and the thousands of fans who supported them deserved our best effort. The university appeal, however, was challenging from the beginning. The facts of this case are simply terrible, causing many to find the detail of the appeal not compelling. It is also important to note that precedent for such a case does not exist, and that the NCAA Infractions Committee has wide discretion as it determines penalties. The NCAA's ruling cannot change the accomplishments of or the excitement generated by our men's basketball team. It cannot change the love we have for this great university. I hope you will join me in remembering those players and their accomplishments. Today,
So that's the stance of the University of Louisville's interim president, Greg Postel. He's saying that the NCAA can do nothing to take away the memories of those great accomplishments. Number one, yes, they can, because I don't remember them very well anyway. Number two, they kind of have to, do they not? Now, let's go back and compare. This is what that line that he said there, you know, cannot take away. That's what reminded me of the 30 for 30 that I just rewatched with the Fab Five and Jimmy King saying, people will always remember us. They only remember the team who won. Louisville was in a very different story, a different place here. We are talking, excuse me again, I'm still fighting this cold. That's why Jim sat in for me yesterday. Kush, I certainly appreciate that.
And I'm no problem.
Now you might have to help out later. But the Michigan story was a little different because it was about a booster named Ned Martin who was giving improper benefits to these players, et cetera, et cetera. It's a little bit different than academic scandal and players who are academically ineligible to perform or ineligible for a variety of other reasons. In the NCAA Appeals Committee on Infractions ruling today that it has upheld the initial ruling from the committee to vacate those wins and to institute these punishments is because of a number of ineligible players. And it's a big deal. The ruling marks the first time in NCAA history that a men's basketball national title has been removed from the record books. So they would not have taken that extraordinary step if the violations were not egregious. And I think they really were. The scandal within the program involved so many things from academic misconduct to sexual favors and sex parties being thrown on campus and being allegedly organized by assistant basketball coaches and so many other things. We are talking about truly, Jim, the words that most athletic directors and coaches they hate to hear, the words that are the most damaging to them are lack of institutional control. And that was going on at Louisville. The lack of institutional control. The director of basketball, former director of basketball at Louisville, was said to have committed, quote, serious violations by allowing and arranging a striptease, dance, and sex acts for prospects, for recruiting prospects, student athletes, and others, did not cooperate with the investigation. The violations in the case resulted in some men's basketball student athletes competing while ineligible. Rick Pitino was forced to resign from his position in disgrace, even after winning that championship, because he, like John Calipari, I've said many times, is about one of the slipperiest, nastiest snakes working in the college game in any sport, and has been for a very, very long time. They finally caught up to him and caught up to them in the kind of program that those guys ran. And this was the right decision. The question, though, from our point of view and for our purpose of discussion, and of course you can feel free to tackle this if you want, is does the list of national champions in college basketball history now just include the word none after the letter or the year 2013? Does it just say 2013 colon none? Does it say parentheses Louisville but title was vacated? Does it say Michigan, considering the fact that it was the Wolverines who had that magical Cinderella run into the final against Louisville in 2013 and lost 74-68, something like that? 82-76. Never mind. 82-76. Does it say Michigan? What does it say? That's the question here. That's the question here is are we just now saying nobody won the championship that year? It was that entire year played for nothing, Jim?
Well, you know, they can claim little rules and take down banners all they want. But when you were laying it out that way, you know what kept popping into my head?
What?
The USC championship in football. You know, we don't like Pete Carroll that much. There are some shady things going on at USC, but we don't pretend there wasn't a champion that year, even if there's no banners or anything. And I feel the same way on this one.
I suppose to the letter of the law, you're right. We don't pretend, but I mean, we do, but we don't. And the only reason we do, I think, you know, where we still acknowledge it is because the way that championship in 2006 was won.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was the great all-time Rose Bowl, you know, between yep. Vince Young and Texas and no, I'm sorry. That wasn't the one because they lost that one.
They lost that one. There was one the year or two before.
About the one that they won. No, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right. They had a little mini dynasty there. They had a little mini dynasty.
Right.
I don't remember which year it was. But the point is Reggie Bush no longer has the Heisman Trophy, correct?
Technically, yes.
I mean, literally, he had to physically turn the actual bronze statue over back to the NCAA, to the downtown athletic club.
That's my understanding.
Yeah, that's what I think happened. And same thing. So they took the banners down for the Fab Five. They're going to take the banner down for the University of Louisville. So is everybody okay? And I'm just wondering, because I actually looked this up before the show today, Jim. According to what I read, no, the NCAA will not consider the University of Michigan, who was the runner-up in the 2013 season, the national champion. They will just say that the championship was vacated. But I don't know if I necessarily like that. When Ben Johnson, and I'm going to go before your time here a little bit, the 1988 Seoul Olympics, when Ben Johnson demolished Carl Lewis in that showdown for fastest man on the planet in Seoul, and then tested positive for steroids, they stripped him of the gold medal. It didn't just say vacant, and Carl Lewis has silver. Carl Lewis got the gold. Carl Lewis, now who was cheated by that opponent, ascended to the gold medal. What I want to know is, and whether they do it officially or just in the minds of Michigan fans, can they now lay claim to another national championship? Louisville had it, shouldn't have had it, because they broke the rules in playing academic, yeah, or ineligible players. So why isn't Michigan now considered the 2013 national champion?
I guess if Michigan wanted to, you know, they could. I mean, look at the jokes that have been going on since January about Central Florida.
Well, yeah, but they have more of a claim than Central Florida does. Florida didn't make the national championship.
To put it in perspective, I guess I'm saying if Michigan wanted to, yeah, you know, I'm sure they could. And FYI, I looked it up. USC, their football title I referenced, that was against Oklahoma, and they crushed the Sooners in that game. Are the Sooners now the national champions for, I think it was 2004 or something?
In my mind, yes. If the champion cheated and wasn't allowed to win it, then the team that finished second now ascends to the title. Maybe I'm crazy, but that's just the way that I look. It's something I want to talk about. Maybe something we can kick around on Twitter as well, because I got to get out now to make room for college basketball talk coming up. And ironically, like I said, we were talking about Michigan and the Fab Five. Now we're going to bring it full circle to Michigan today. Wolverines riding high after beating the Ohio State Buckeyes, giving the Buckeyes their second straight loss after Purdue took them down as well. So we're going to talk with Von Lowe's at AmazingBrew.com coming up next. Then at 4:40, Jim Cushlin is going to continue our Mac love as he talks with Todd Walker, the voice of the Bowling Green State Falcons. We bring you the best live and local coverage of Mac basketball right here as well on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Back after this. Hour number two of the extravaganza is indeed underway right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Nice little montage put together by Mr. Cushlin as we get into hour two. A lot of interesting rules stuff in the first hour, talking about the NBA and their potential change to a seeding system, top 16 instead of just East and West in years to come, and then also, of course, on baseball's pace of play stuff. But now we want to get into the action on the court or field, as it were. And in this case, we're talking college basketball, a lot of it, as a matter of fact, this half hour. And joining us now is Von Lozen of MazeandBrew.com. And Von is going to tell us about the mighty, mighty Michigan Wolverines, who avenged an earlier loss to the Ohio State Buckeyes and took the Buckeyes down to complete a 2-0 week that has them jumping five spots in the latest AP Top 25 poll. They are now sitting at number 17. Von Lozen is sitting here with us. Hey, Von, how are you?
Hey, doing good. How are you guys?
We're good. Thanks for the time. Boy, I'll tell you what, you know, it looked like the two, you know, the two rivals, Michigan and Ohio State, were headed in opposite directions after their last meeting. Ohio State has just been on a crazy roll, and Michigan lost a few games that kind of made you wonder, what are they really going to be? Kind of an up-and-down thing. But now it seems to have shifted again. The Buckeyes have lost a pair, and Michigan had a 2-0 week, including that win over Ohio State. So what has keyed the turnaround for the Wolverines, Von, at least in recent games?
Well, it's been really about their lockdown defense, and that's kind of what it's been about most of the year. That's predominantly why they were able to come back against UCLA, force overtime, and eventually win that game back in December. Same thing with Texas. And that's why they had so much success against Ohio State in their first matchup. They really pulled ahead in that first half. They were up by 17 points, 20 points, something like that. Let it slip away from them. Their defense really struggled in that second half there. But a lot of it has been about the defense, especially in this game. They limited their top players really well. Bates Diop, he was only 5 of 17 from the field. He had 17 points. Jayshon Tate, He also had 20 points, but he was also 9 of 14. So their two leaders played really well, but everyone else, it didn't seem like they were able to contribute all that well. And I think a lot of that has been because of the Wolverines' defense. I would say another big part is their free throws, which is something that they've really struggled with this season, especially Xavier Simpson, their sophomore point guard. He, at one point, his three-point shooting percentage was better than his free throw percentage, which is kind of unbelievable. It's just a hard thing to grasp there. It's kind of changed over the past month or so, but especially in this Ohio State game over the weekend, he kind of changed up his free throw, the way that he goes about shooting free throws. He kind of motions, turns his side, his torso to the right side of him, starts dribbling a little bit, then turns back and then shot. And it's kind of a little strange, but he went 4 of 6. Which is definitely better. He was under 50% from the free throw line going into the game. I think he's really close to that 50% line after the game, after going 4-6. So a little bit of both the defense, the free throws, and then you get your sharpshooter Jordan Poole into the game, and he lights it up from the bench, contributes 15 points. That's definitely going to help him too.
I'm waiting for the first guy who feels more comfortable launching threes than free throws to say, can I back up? You know, you're not allowed to go over the line, but you're sure allowed to go as far back as you want, I would imagine. And if you feel more comfortable back there, it's probably not going to, no coach would really like that, but who knows? Von, I mentioned the run. Let's the way the season has gone. Going back to the Wolverines lost to Ohio State the first time, they actually reeled off 2, 4, 6, 7 wins in a row. Then came that stretch I was talking about where they had lost actually 4 of 9. They were 5-4 to a 9-game stretch prior to this 3-game winning streak now, and that's why I asked what the difference was. And you think the real key is lockdown defense. Is that been against everybody, or is that just what you noticed in the difference between the first Ohio State game and then the win over Ohio State this time around?
And for the most part, in most of their games, I would say, especially that first Purdue game, that was one of the best defensive performances that they had all season. Purdue at that time was, I think, number 5 in the country, and they lost by just a single point. And then they went to Purdue and only lost by a handful. I think they only lost by 4 points.
I think it was 92-88, I believe, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that game, one of the games that you were kind of alluding to is that game at Nebraska in the middle of January, they lost by 20 points. By far the worst defensive performance that they had all season. And Nebraska actually countered their defense really well with some real nice defense of their own. You know, they limited Mo Wagner. I think he only had 2 points or 4 points or something along those lines in that game. So when your superstar forward isn't having a good night, you're probably not going to have a good night either. Now, the whole team really struggled in that game defensively. Nebraska, albeit they did have some nice bounces go their way on the rim and off the backboard, but you know, it's just going to happen like that from time to time. Definitely not their best defensive performance, but yeah, I would say for the most part throughout this, and at least throughout the Big Ten season, and most of their success has come from the defensive side of the ball, being able to force turnovers, something that they did really well against Michigan State, something that they did fairly well, I would say, against Ohio State the second time around. And even in that Wednesday of last week against Iowa, they were able to force some turnovers in that game too. So I would definitely say on the defensive side of the ball, that's their forte. That's been you know, something that they really strive to be good at, which is something that John Beilein teams typically you know, aren't very good at. Typically, out of a John Beilein team, you're going to see, you know, a lot of threes being shot. You're going to try to get as much offensive power as you can and just kind of hope for some success on defense, on the defensive side. But this year it's been a little bit different, and it's kind of strange to see, but it's working out for them. So, you know, if it works, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, you know.
Amen to that. We're talking to Von Lozen, a little Michigan basketball, shining a little spotlight or giving a little love to Michigan. We talk to Paul Keels, the voice of the Buckeyes, usually once a week, and we really need to put a little bit more pay a little bit more attention to Michigan, especially since the Wolverines did just take down Ohio State. 2 straight wins for the Wolverines. Ohio State has lost 2 in a row after ascending to the top of the Big Ten. Just 2 regular season games remain for the Wolverines before the Big Ten Conference Tournament. Von Lozen from Mazin Brew is our guest. Jim Kushlin is here as well. Jim, go ahead.
And thinking about the giving that love to Michigan, you know, they're still a ranked team, so they're still going to go to the tournament coming up here in a couple of weeks. And obviously with the Big Ten, this is the last week of the regular season before the Big Ten tournament. And, you know, Von, in a position where Michigan is, I couldn't help but notice that with the three overall wins now in a row and four of their last five that they have, they're now tied with Nebraska in terms of the Big Ten standings. But as you mentioned, Nebraska beat Michigan, you know, earlier in the season. That's the only time they'll meet, so that would be the possible tiebreaker, and that's a very important one because Michigan right now is tied with Nebraska for that four spot. In other words, what I'm saying is it's going to be a tough week. These are not bad teams, but they're not great teams either, and they're both on the road. I would think Michigan's got to do what they can, keep building on especially some of these defensive things you were talking about so that they can at least get a quarterfinal bye in the upcoming Big Ten tournament next week, because as of right now, they would lose out on the tiebreaker to Nebraska and therefore have to start a day earlier in that second round. Your thoughts?
Yeah, exactly. And that's why that Nebraska-Illinois game right after the Michigan game on Sunday was so important as well. They ended up losing at Illinois. You know, they kind of struggled down the stretch there, ended up taking the loss, and that's kind of what forced that tie right now with Nebraska, as you said, getting the tiebreaker because they beat Michigan earlier in the season. Tonight, I believe they play Indiana at home. I think their last two games are actually both at home. They play Indiana and then Penn State on Sunday. So Penn State's one of those surging teams that they've played really well. They've beaten Ohio State. They kept it really close against Michigan State. They've been playing really well with those top-tier teams. And Penn State is Michigan's next opponent here on Wednesday. So you know, a lot of things can change within the next few days here. But yeah, I mean, it's a huge, at that point, when they lost to Nebraska, it didn't seem like it was, you know, a huge deal because, you know, oh, okay, you know, it's Nebraska, you know, they're not a basketball school, but now all of a sudden, they've been competing with everybody. They beat Maryland. They've beaten pretty much all they beat Minnesota, who's supposed to be really good this season. They've played fairly well, quite honestly. So it is interesting that, you know, a month ago, you wouldn't think that that game would have had a huge impact in the way that these tournament seedings, you know, kind of unfold during the last week of the regular season. But now here we are kind of saying, what if, you know, what if they didn't have their worst defensive performance on the road against Nebraska a month ago? Now they would, you know, have a for sure fourth seed in the tournament, have that double bye, but now they kind of have to have some luck go their way. They got to win these next two. This week, they got to beat Penn State. They got to beat Maryland. Both those are on the road. And now Nebraska has their final two games at home. And I would imagine that that would help them out a little bit at the very least. I know they've got surging Penn State, and Indiana's been playing fairly decent basketball as of late as well. So it's going to be interesting to see how this last week of the regular season kind of plays out.
We're talking to Von Lozen, who writes for MazinBrew.com. That is the Wolverine site for SB Nation. And, you know, Von, let's talk. I want to get two predictions from you. Well, number one is just in the next game. Penn State is no joke. They've beaten Ohio State twice now, as we pointed out, and the second time they pounded them by 23 points. How important is it to get this win? I know you said they really have to win both these games on the road against Penn State and Maryland, but you know, give me your matchup there and how your analysis of that game and what Michigan will have to do to win that game. And then the second prediction will be a little tougher because I'm asking you to forecast past these last two games for everybody into the Big Ten tournament. But while we have you here, I'm just going to ask you point blank who you think will win this tournament. So go ahead and take those in that order.
Yeah, sure. Well, when it comes to the Penn State game, like I said earlier, Michigan's going to have to play lockdown defense once again. That's how they've stayed in all these games this year. That's been their forte. It's been their bread and butter, being able to force turnovers and get those fast break points. They had quite a bit of fast break points on Sunday against Ohio State, and that's kind of what helped them get those big runs there in the second half to be able to extend their lead, force Ohio State to take some timeouts and really get the momentum on their side and keep it on their side for the rest of the game. So they're going to definitely have to do that against Penn State. And you're right, Penn State is no joke. They took Ohio State, and at home they defeated them, like you said, by more than 20, and they hung around with Purdue on Sunday as well at Purdue. They only lost by 3 points. So like we've all kind of alluded to, you know, they're kind of one of those teams that are a thorn in your side at this point in the Big Ten schedule, just because you know, these tournament seedings are incredibly important, especially for you know, because these teams have been playing so much basketball over the past month or so. They, you know, they don't get a whole lot of breaks. You know, they're constantly on the road, constantly playing. You know, this is really one of the few times that you can get to get some rest before March Madness really kicks in. You get into the NCAA tournament. So these buys, they're incredibly important. So, yeah, Michigan's going to have to definitely play some lockdown defense, force turnovers, and get those fast break points if they want a chance at defeating Penn State. And they're going to have to do the same thing against Maryland, quite honestly. For your second question, who I think is going to win the Big Ten tournament, you know, if I had to choose right now, I'd probably choose Michigan State, just because they've won so many games in a row, eight or nine at this point in a row. They had a huge comeback against Northwestern over the weekend. They were down by 27 points. We're able to limit them to only 11 points in that second half, which is incredible, just to say that. But had a huge comeback. You know, they've hung around with the best in the Big Ten, the best in the country. I think they've only lost just a handful of games this entire year. You know, really played nicely against Duke early in the season. So as of right now, I would probably say Michigan State. But, you know, you got a couple dark horses like Penn State, like we've been talking about. They've been playing really good as of late. So if they take their hot streak into the Big Ten tournament, I could see them getting to the finals or maybe the semifinals. So I would say Penn State's definitely a dark horse. Michigan's got their chance. Ohio State has their chance. You know, Purdue has their chance, but I think as of now, it'd probably be Michigan State.
Michigan State, the favorite right now. Kush, what do you think?
One thing I wanted to say real quick on this specific game for Michigan coming up against Penn State, for what it's worth, guys, when I talked with Paul Keels on the Buckeye side of things yesterday, we recounted that Penn State loss for the Buckeyes last week. The one thing that stood out to me is that Penn State, not known as a basketball school, doesn't get a lot of big crowds. One of the biggest, loudest crowds, Mr. Keel said, he ever experienced in Happy Valley. So crowd will actually be a little bit of a factor when it usually is not at Penn State. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting side note. I had no idea that that they turned up there for basketball. So that's...
No, I mean, I would absolutely expect that in the, you know, in the actual Happy Valley that is that stadium, the football stadium, but they're really jacked up there for their basketball team. And again, when they've beaten Ohio State twice now, and they've beaten some very good teams, they're trying to make that move into the upper echelon, not only of the Big Ten, but nationally, and trying to shake that reputation as being a football-only school. And that's what it takes. It takes victories over teams, you know, like Ohio State and like Michigan to do that. They would like nothing better. You know, this is kind of weird, Von Lozen, because obviously we always talk about the Ohio State-Michigan football game and the rivalry there, and how you know, Jim Harbaugh has struggled to get any footing, any traction against Urban Meyer since he came back, or since he, you know, took the Michigan program over, and he's also struggled against Penn State. That threesome between Michigan, Ohio State, and Penn State, and that's not to leave Michigan State out of it, but that has kind of become, you know, the little football devil's triangle, if you will. And, you know, Penn State wants to be just as good in basketball. And Michigan, for that matter, is trying to restore its reputation as being one of the top programs in the country, not just in the Big Ten. So, you know, these, every time any one of those three teams play each other, it really seems to be, you know, they're ramping up the intensity just a little bit, maybe than a little bit more than they had previous.
Yeah, definitely an interesting point. Kind of like an unwritten rivalry or something like that, you know?
Just because of greatness, not geography or history with Ohio State, Michigan football has that. But Penn State just kind of, when they came to the conference, played their way into it, where there is kind of a really interesting rivalry now between those three schools, you know, for being at the top of the conference.
Yeah, that's definitely a really good point. You know, even earlier in the football year when Michigan traveled to Penn State for, you know, the prime time, 8 o'clock, you know, they had a whiteout. It was their whiteout game. They always have one a year. So yeah, they definitely came out against the football team, and hopefully they come out against the basketball team too. It'll definitely be interesting to watch that.
No question about it. Jim Christian, you said you had something else on the football side?
Yeah, I just want to get your thoughts, Vaughn. The one football news for Michigan that trickled out in the last week or so. Jim McElwain, formerly of Florida, he's now on Jim Harbaugh's staff and as an assistant. What are your thoughts on that? What do you think he'll bring to the Wolverines on the football field?
Well, it's definitely interesting news. You know, in their first football game last year, Michigan and Florida met in Arlington, Texas at Jerry World. And, you know, they, at the very end of the game, Jim Harbaugh and Jim McElwain shake hands. And it's kind of interesting that that would be the last time that they would have interaction before, you know, kind of, now becoming, colleagues there over in Ann Arbor. It's definitely interesting to think of things like that. And, you know, kind of how Michigan derailed Florida's start to the year, kind of unraveled everything, and the way that it unfolded. McElwain parted ways with Florida, ended up getting this wide receivers coach job at U of M. He's going to bring quite a bit of experience. He was the offensive coordinator at Alabama during their little run there at national championships in the, I think it was 2011, and one of those other seasons there. So he brings plenty of offensive experience. Did all the play calls there at Alabama during their championship run. Was the head coach of Colorado State. He turned their program around, ended up getting a 10-win season by his third year at the program. Then he got promoted, got the Florida job, and won the SEC East twice, two times in a row. I believe that was actually the first time that a new SEC coach ever did that. So he has had some success. Especially offensively, developing offensive talent, you know, pretty much at every stop that he's ever been at. So it's going to be interesting. It's something that Michigan definitely needed. They didn't have a full-time wide receivers coach last year, and it definitely showed with the inexperience from the receiver core, with the struggles from the freshman, Donovan Peoples-Jones. He struggled there midseason. Nico Collins didn't really get going until the Wisconsin game, Ohio State, and then the bowl game. So I think he's going to bring a lot of knowledge, a lot of experience, and it's definitely going to be interesting to see how this all unfolds as well, just given the youth at the wide receiver group at U of M and given just all the experiences that McElwain's had, of pretty much all throughout
I think
the
that's the key word, if I may jump in, because we're a little short on time here, Vaughn, but I think you're right. You cannot bring in enough experienced coaching on a staff. And Jim McElwain, absolutely. You know, just having been named the head coach at Florida at all, even though he didn't necessarily have the record there he would like to have had, indicates his coaching ability and aptitude, and it'll certainly be a big boost, I think, for Harbaugh's staff and for the Wolverines. Vaughn Lozen, read him, follow him on MazinBrew.com. MazinBrew.com, that's the Wolverines SB Nation site. Wanted to give a little love to the Wolverine basketball program after taking down the Buckeyes, and good luck against Penn State. Vaughn, we'll check in with you again real soon.
All right, great. Thanks for having me on.
You got it, Vaughn. Vaughn Lozen joining us there, and we're going to stay on the college basketball theme, by the way. Coming up here after the bottom of the hour, local sports center comes your way. Well, normally we shine the light on Toledo and Bowling Green once a week. Head coaches Todd Kowalczyk and Michael Huger. When Coach Huger is unavailable, we talk to the voice of Bowling Green basketball, and that would be Todd Walker. So Todd is going to be joining us after the bottom of the hour, local sports center. After I ask you this question, do you need a new roof? $1 down. Need new siding? $1 down. Need new windows? Just $1 down. Get a new look, your choice, roof, siding, or windows for just $1 down. That's the power of 7 years interest-free. That's right. Do not delay. Call WeatherSeal today. Get the roof, siding, and windows you've always wanted for $1 down when you finance for 7 years interest-free. Call this number, 877-WINDOWS. That's WeatherSeal. Call 877-WINDOWS. Call 877-WINDOWS or get online at WeatherSealHomeServices.com.
And welcome back into the extravaganza. Final segment here on this Tuesday edition. We've been talking a lot of college basketball here in this 4 o'clock hour today. Did Ohio State yesterday, a little Michigan earlier today. Now time to shift gears to the Bowling Green Falcons. Split the week last week, but still in pretty good position overall. 7-7 in the East. The East division now being clinched by Buffalo, but 16-11 overall. Basically, they're in a four-way tie at this moment with 2 weeks to play to get a bye straight to the queue. for the MAC tournament coming up in a couple weeks. And to help us break all of these things down and so much more, we once again welcome back to the program the voice of the Bowling Green Falcons, Todd Walker, joining us. Good afternoon, Todd. How you doing today?
Hey, Jim, doing well, doing real well.
Excellent, excellent. Glad to hear. So we had a split week, as I mentioned, for the Falcons. They get the win, a close win against Western, fell at Buffalo on Friday. Just first, give me your initial thoughts from those couple of games last week. Buffalo obviously clinching the East Division with that win against the Falcons, but that's kind of understandable loss the way Bowling Green, or Buffalo, I should say, has been playing this year. But then earlier in the week, a week ago, getting a nice win against Western Michigan. Break down those games for me.
Well, you know, the Western Michigan game was the third straight home game the Falcons won while trailing by as many as 15 points at some time in the game, so it was become a rather ho-hum way this team likes to do things, apparently, and that is fall behind in games before coming back to win. But that was a quality win over a good Western Michigan team, and very much a boost for Bowling Green heading into that game at Buffalo on Friday. The Bulls are the best team in the league, and really Bowling Green played with them most of the game, but Buffalo is really good at getting out on the break and a few breakdowns here and there, and they can exploit that, and they were able to do that and ended up pulling away at the end. But I think Bowling Green learned a lot about what it will take to beat Buffalo if they get another chance at them, which they will, to end the regular season. But I thought they played pretty well on the road at Buffalo, and I'd like to see them get another shot and play better when they get them in Bowling Green.
And that game, by the by, will be Friday, March 2nd, as you mentioned, Todd, to end the regular season before we head into the Mid-American Conference Tournament. Real quick on both of these games. First, for the Western Michigan game, as you mentioned, coming back from a couple times down 15 in this particular game, and I've asked this from Coach Huger at points this season when there's been a game like that, how important is that, is to make those kind of comebacks when you're still a younger team? I know Wiggins is a junior, but everybody else is pretty much on the younger scale of things. From your vantage point, your perch, the not the head coach perspective, what does it do to a team, a younger team, when they're able to make those kind of comebacks at times during the season, like we saw against Western?
Well, I think it's good that this team will always believe that it can come back, because it's inevitable that, especially in a tournament setting, you're going to get to a point in games probably where you feel like maybe it's getting away from you and your season's about to come to an end. I think, you know, this team doesn't really accept that at any point. You know, there's been a number of games this season, as I mentioned, where they've been down and they've come back to win. That Western game was actually the seventh time this year they've won a game in which they trailed at some point by at least double digits. So, you know, they've won games where their win probability was at 4%, 5%, 6%. According to the gurus that track that stuff.
Right.
So I think on that side of things, it's good that they have routinely made these comebacks. On the other hand, they've also, while not blown officially big leads to lose, they did have a 15-point lead against Central, end up losing that game. There have been other games this year where they've given away most or all of a big lead and then went on to win the game. So on the negative side of things, I think this team has too many bad stretches that either give up leads or dig big holes, and then they get somehow focused in on what they need to do and turn the game around. I think if you can eliminate or lessen those deep valleys, you can be a much better team in the long run, and that's the challenge moving forward.
We're talking with the voice of the Bowling Green Falcons, Todd Walker, here on the Extravaganza. From a bunch of what you just said, how much would you chalk any of that up, if any, to the whole young team concept? It's a theme in my talks over the course of the season with Coach Michael Huger that this is still a young team, and it is. How much of those things that we were just talking about, though, whether it's giving up the big lead or coming back from the bigger deficit, how much of that could be just attributed to that's what young teams do sometimes?
Well, I think there's certainly a component to that, but I'm also a bit of a believer in, the youth starts to become less of an excuse now. I mean, all these guys have been playing together for this whole season. The team has not really had any major injury problems other than somebody missing a game here and there. And I think it's just about individually more of these guys have to take responsibility for being on point all the time. I still think that too many guys are not focused at all times, and that's something you have to get over. You can't use an excuse, well, we're young. Well, yeah, you're young, but some of the guys that are losing focus are guys that are sophomores, not freshmen, guys that have played 30, 40, 50 games as collegians, and then those excuses, I think, start to wear thin toward the end of this season now with the young component. I think now they've almost forged an identity of being a comeback team, and they simply have to figure out a way to stop doing that. If this team would play the way it's capable of from start to finish, things are going to work out a lot better.
Let's talk a little more about that Buffalo game. You mentioned that that there's a possible formula found out in that game, and that the Falcons will have another chance, as you mentioned, at Stroh Center coming up to end the regular season on Friday, March the 2nd. What were those kind of things that we saw in that game that if you're going to play Buffalo, whether you're the Falcons or not, that one can use to beat them?
Well, I think clearly they did some things very well. One thing, they got to the free throw line a ton, which is something that Coach Huger talked about in the time leading up to the game, and they executed that well. They battled them pretty even on the boards, actually had a one-rebound advantage, so I think that was good. But the thing that hurt them in that Buffalo game, there were just a few possessions, you know, scattered throughout the game where you let your guard down, either throw up a bad shot that leads to a run out for Buffalo, or you have just a lapse in your transition defense, and you just can't do it with Buffalo. They're too experienced, too consistent, too good, and too deep to have those momentary lapses. Even if it's a possession or two, a play or two, a rebound or two, you simply cannot have any letdown. And the fact of the matter is, they had probably four or five little mini letdowns in that game, and Buffalo converted every single time. That's why at the end of the game, you're down 10 instead of down 3 or down 4 or tied. It wasn't that they got outplayed consistently throughout the game. It's just there were a few key possessions, and when you let your guard down or you throw up bad shots or have a defensive breakdown or just a lack of effort and focus, Buffalo burns you every time. And that's the lesson Bowling Green has to learn.
We're talking with the voice of the Bowling Green Falcons, Todd Walker, joining us here on the Extravaganza. Looking forward to this week, Todd. A couple of games against teams we're very familiar with. The second round through of games against teams from the East. It's Akron tonight at home. That was a loss at Akron earlier this year. And then coming up on Saturday on the road to Kent State. First meeting at Stroh. Falcons beat them. Both teams are kind of traditional powers, if you will, in this conference. But Akron really down this year. And despite the fact that Kent State is in that mix with Bowling Green right now, tied at 7-7 for the in conference play, which is important because one of those teams will end up being that number 4 at this moment in time and go straight to the queue. But they're having a relatively down season themselves. They're under 500. What can you tell us about either of these teams, starting with Akron tonight? And from that perspective, what does Bowling Green need to do a little differently to split the season series here?
Well, Akron, you're right. They're down. Coach Dambrot left, and a lot of the players left with him. This team has been undermanned throughout the season. And really, the first game in Akron, I think the Falcons took them a little bit lightly, and they ended up paying the price. The Zips were able to get a big game from the freshman, Rashawn Cotton, including the game-winning three late that turned a one-point deficit into a two-point win. I think, really, the lesson learned from the first game is that you've got to play well the entire game. You can't just kind of coast through. And that was another game where Bowling Green was trailing by 14. Now, they probably should have won the game anyway at the end, but they didn't. You can't keep battling back from 12, 13, 15-point deficits. I think clearly if both teams play well, Bowling Green's the better team. And I think that's what has to show up tonight. You just got to be on point and focused from the beginning and take care of your business. Akron's dangerous, though, shooting the three, and they attempt the second most threes in the league. They really live and die by the three. And if you can defend that three, make it tough on them, you should be able to win this game. And as far as Kent State, it was a barn burner the first time around. Falcons trailed huge in that game as well on their home floor by 19 before storming back to beat Kent State. And really, when you look at that bye, as you have alluded to, right now there's four teams tied at 7-7, Bowling Green, Western, Eastern, and Kent State. Now, Bowling Green has combined 4-0 against those teams. They swept Eastern. They beat Western. Will not play them again. They beat Kent State. They play them Saturday in Kent. Really, if you look at it, if Bowling Green takes care of business tonight and they win at Kent State on Saturday, they'll be in a very good stead to get that fourth seed, especially if they can then go ahead and win at Ohio on Tuesday. In fact, I haven't done all the math. I don't know that you could, but I got the feeling if they win the next three games, that game against Buffalo to end the season will literally mean nothing for the MAC tournament seeding because the Bulls will likely have the one seed wrapped up as well.
No, and that's such a good point. That's obviously something we're going to keep an eye on as this program has been turning around. We've all seen the signs of it, I think, this year, and it would be so cool of them if they can go straight to the queue instead of having to play those that home and road first round. Even though there's a couple days off, that's always funky, the way the MAC tournament is set up, because you have to play it. And even though Bowling Green, for what it's worth, are probably in a position where that game would be at Stroh instead of going on the road, you still, of course, don't want to have to play it if you don't have to. And if you could essentially put yourself as one of the top four teams in the MAC, well, that's showing the progress that I think we're all kind of looking for. Todd Walker, voice of the Falcons, joining us here on the Extravaganza. And that kind of makes me think of one last kind of almost philosophical question. It certainly will end up probably getting into this more as the next couple weeks go by, because it's 3 weeks from now, give or take, is Selection Sunday. And obviously the Falcons are in a position like anybody in the MAC. They'd have to win the conference tournament to get that kind of bid. That's going to be a tall order, I think. Nobody really questions that. But below those tournaments, there is, as far as I know, I haven't seen anything to say otherwise, even though most people are unaware that these things even exist. There are two tournaments below the NCAA and even the NIT. And with the Falcons at 16-11 overall, assuming they don't stumble, in fact, let's just say they do what we were kind of outlining. Say they win these next couple, Buffalo's meaningless, but that's three more wins, and then as long as they don't bow out in round one of the MAC tournament, they're going to have an above 500 record overall. And that's something these littler tournaments who field their whole tournaments based on some of these smaller leagues, that Bowling Green might be able to get a bid to one of those. Now, again, I know we have more time down the line probably to talk about this kind of concept, but how important would it be for the program, even though a lot of us joke that there's more tournaments besides the not important NIT, but I think that would be a very good thing for this program to be able to go and play in one of those. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would say that the die is almost cast with that they will play in one of those if they get an invite. If they don't run the table in the MAC tournament, they certainly don't have a shot at an NCAA at-large bid. You're not going to get even an NIT at-large bid. At that point, the regular season champ would get the automatic bid to the NIT if that team doesn't win the tournament. So I would say this program is at a point where it would want to accept one of those bids to the CBI or the CIT. Sometimes it doesn't make as much sense for what type of team you have. Now, if you had an older team that had really been a contending team coming into the season and now it's a bit of a disappointment, maybe you don't want to continue playing. And this team, I think, would be highly of a mind they would want to continue playing. So I would pretty much make plans for that scenario to happen if they don't win the MAC tournament. I think they're very much ready to move into one of those other tournaments should that invite come, and I think it would. You're right about having a winning record. That would be key. Really, if they win one more game, they could not fall below 500 then after that. If you get to 17 wins, they would lock in a winning record. So that would be first thing to do, and I would say the CBI would be the one I would think is the most likely.
And that's a very interesting dynamic you lay out, because you're right, an older team, a lot of juniors and seniors on a type of team that maybe was contending in their conference before, and this would be viewed as a kind of a down, a fallbacks kind of season. They might not play, but a program like the Falcons, younger team like they are, trying to establish something here, I gotta believe if they get an invite, they will with smiles on their face accept that bid just to keep playing some basketball and get that tournament kind of feel. I think it would be just the kind of thing, Todd, that I think would be really, really good and cool for this program, even if most people don't even realize these other tournaments below the NIT even exist. They're out there, and you are so right. The Falcons look primed to be a possible participant in one of those. Todd Walker, he is the voice of the Bowling Green Falcons. Catch all of his great calls of the Falcons all season long through the MAC tournament, and it sounds like maybe through one of these other possible postseason tournaments after that. Todd, we always appreciate the time. We'll certainly catch up with you down the line into MAC tournament time. How's that sound?
That sounds great, Jim. Thanks.
That is Todd Walker, voice of the Bowling Green Falcons, joining us. And that's why, you know, now we're getting to the end of March. We got 1 week left, you know, before the calendar flips to March. And that's when a lot of our attention really goes to these things. And you know, this is the type of question I've been holding off for a couple weeks, not just for Todd, but for head coach Michael Huger as well. Because, yes, first of all, folks, as far as I know, there are still such a things as the CBI and the CIT for these smaller conferences below even the NIT. I know we all like to joke that the NIT is the not important tournament, and we all kind of know that that's true, and that we're some of you are even stunned to probably find out that there are actually college basketball tournaments even below the NIT. So they don't have the kind of luster. But yeah, if the Falcons could be above 500, which looks almost certain at this point, and if they can do some things that Todd was outlining, like win some of these next couple of games because of Akron, Kent State, and Ohio all being a little bit down, and then you close the season with Buffalo, I mean, you put yourself in a position where you're possibly top four in the conference. That gets you a bye to the queue for the MAC tournament, and that plus an above 500 record and being a more up-and-coming team, meaning likely to accept one of those bids, means that the CBI and the CIT people are probably very much looking into the possibility of having a team like Bowling Green play in one of their tournaments. And again, even though we all joke about anything that's not the NCAA tournament, and again, some of you probably aren't even aware these other two actually exist, and for the record, they do. This will be like the fifth or sixth season that each of these tournaments has existed. Yeah, I know. But it would be so good, I think, for a program like the Falcons to be able to play in one of these tournaments. You know, it's a young team. We've all more or less been thinking it. Even Coach Michael Huger has more or less alluded to this in our conversations with him, that next year is the real year that the program is circling to, in theory, do some damage and really contend. This is the jump start season, in theory, on paper, for all of that. And if you can cap it off, even if it's just the CIT or the CBI, if you can cap it off after all this, be above 500, at least not lose in whatever your first game in the MAC tournament is. Right now, they are, as Todd pointed out, they have beaten Eastern, Western, and Kent State. So technically, there are four teams in 7-7. Bowling Green has the tiebreaker. They come in right now as the one team that gets the bye, along with Buffalo, Toledo, and Ball State, to the queue in Cleveland for the MAC tournament. So a CBI or CIT looks at all those things and says, that's the type of team we're looking for one of these tournaments. We know a lot of you fans out there don't care as much or don't even realize some of these exist. But for a program in the state where the Falcons are, playing in one of those is, I think, huge for the future of the program. It gets you used to that, not just conference tournament play kind of thing. It gets you used to playing good teams, because for what it's worth, a lot of these teams, they're smaller schools. That's why they're, you know, those in smaller leagues that might only send one team to both the NCAA and NIT. And so where do the rest who might have almost 20 wins go? Well, they go to one of these to play some postseason basketball. And especially if you're a young team, and a program that's trying to build something the way the Falcons are. And again, we've been seeing it all season long. The beginnings, clearly, of the program going in a good, different place. And you want to be actually involved in one of these tournaments. It does nothing but give the kids that better experience. Plus, just like in football, going to a bowl game, if you're head coach Michael Huger, you're looking for any excuse to keep the guys together, to keep practicing, to keep your season going as long as possible. So I hope that after we get through these next 3 weeks, two regular season, one of the MAC tournament, that we see Bowling Green's name on a line, at least in the CBI or CIT. And I have to check with Todd and the rest of the BG guys, but I'm pretty sure we would have any CBI, CIT Falcons games for you over on Talk Radio 100.7, your home of the Falcons. And that's going to do it for this Tuesday edition of the Extravaganza. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. Mike Miller, Drive Time's coming at you next. And then immediately following Drive Time, Bill Clark and the crew will have a great set of calls for you. The City League semifinals. It's a tradition, of course, here in Toledo in the old City League. 6 o'clock. That all gets underway right after Drive Time here in the Ticket. Start versus Woodward, then Rogers versus Bowser. As because of the City League semis, we had to move Ohio State against Rutgers. That's on tonight, 6:30 coverage time. That's over in Talk Radio 100.7. And then for you Night Owls, we'll cap it off on the ice, Olympic style. The U.S. survived last night to play another day. That another day comes tonight at 10, courtesy of our friends at Westwood One, right here on the on 100.7, because we'll have the Olympic recap show 10 to midnight here on the Ticket. So 10 o'clock, 100.7, can USA keep it going? Quarterfinal matchup against the Czech Republic from the Olympics. So lots of fun action for you tonight. Stick around. Mike Miller's on Drive Time next, and we'll do it all again for a super fun Wednesday tomorrow. See you then.